And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Our mission, as we've said many times, is to bring the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet direct to you via conversations. You can listen to these conversations, of course, wherever you consume your favorite podcasts, on equip.org, iTunes, various other places. But if you go to iTunes and give us a five-star rating, this podcast will be heard by many, many more people than otherwise. You can also share the podcast with family members, friends, people within your sphere of influence. Today, I have a very special Hank Unplugged podcast with Justin Brierley. He's the host of Unbelievable. This is a broadcast and a podcast that is based in the United Kingdom, and it is the flagship apologetics and theology debate program of a great radio network called Premier Christian Radio. And for more than a decade, Justin has been moderating in-depth discussions with Christians and skeptics, as well as debates, I should say, among Christians on very critical topics. He has a background in drama, in studies in philosophy, politics, economics, all at Oxford University. He's married. His wife, Lucy, is a minister of a church in Surrey, England. And he is the author of a very significant book. I had a lot of fun reading it the other day. It's called Unbelievable: Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I Am Still a Christian. As host of Unbelievable, Justin has run into all kinds of common objections. Objections like, I don't need to believe in God to be a good person. Or how can God be the source of morality when the Bible is so full of immorality? And then the hands-down favorite of atheist professors, my kids have run into this one, the Euthyphro dilemma. It's, of course, named after one of Plato's famed dialogues. The dialogue purportedly puts the Greek gods and vicariously the God of the Bible on the horns of a dilemma. Is something good because the gods will it? Or do the gods will it because it's good? So if we say that something is good because the gods will it, we immediately perceive a problem. Goodness, or the lack thereof, is left in the hands of capricious gods. So right or wrong, good or bad, they become arbitrary, and the gods might well have dictated, therefore, that a rape is a moral imperative because that's their opinion, that's their arbitrary perspective, despite what our intuitive revulsions might be. And if we say that the gods will something because it's good, well, we're gored by the opposite horn of the dilemma. Good and evil, right and wrong, now have become autonomous. And if that's so, the gods are subordinate. They're not sovereign. Of course, in truth, this is nothing short of a false dilemma. Perhaps I'd call it a ruse. Because by saying that something is good, because it reflects the nature of God, good and evil, right and wrong, are therefore neither arbitrary nor autonomous. God wills what he wills because he is good, and what he wills is right because it is reflective of and consistent with his nature. Now, the point of all of this is that when we get out of our own echo chambers, when we get out of our own psycho-epistemological cocoons and listen to opposite points of view, we discover that what is posited oftentimes as a dilemma in reality is no dilemma at all. If Plato's Euthyphro serves a purpose, it is to teach us to question the question rather than assuming that the question is valid. And I say all of that because this is precisely what my Hank Unplugged guest does on his broadcast and his podcast. Again, they're called Unbelievable. He's positing provocative questions, and he's allowing those listening in to make up their own minds. And this has become a phenomenon all over the UK and now all over the world. And that is why I am delighted to have Justin Brierley with me on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Hank, and I can only hope I can live up to that tremendous introduction that you gave me.
Well, reading your book, you've already lived up to the introduction, and I understand that the downloads are in the millions.
Yes, yes. It just seems to be growing each year. I think we clocked about 3 million downloads last year, and I think we're looking at probably getting 3.5 million by the end of this year, looking at the way it's going. So it's great that people seem to be really enjoying the show. I keep hearing of new people who are picking it up. And this is both Christians and non-Christians, which is really thrills me because I love that the show has become a place where we have those kinds of dialogues, which seem to attract both sides to the conversation.
Talk about the synergy between podcasts and broadcasts. I mean, the fact that you do a broadcast and then you put it online has caused this to become explosive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of it as much as a podcast as a radio broadcast, if not more, to be honest, as a podcast, just because by its nature, podcasting means that you're getting a self-selecting audience. It's very much an audience who come to your show for that particular purpose, for that particular material. You're obviously casting the net wider with a radio broadcast. You know, my show goes out on a Saturday afternoon on our network, and you essentially snag whoever happens to be listening at that time on average. You may get some listeners who specifically, you know, wait by their radio set for your particular program. But these days, anyone who wants that particular show, they can go and get it on a podcast, you know, or wherever they get their streaming services from. And so in that sense, the show, nonetheless, still, it's really helpful that we're a radio broadcast, because I think, firstly, for me, that forces me to think about, okay, not everyone who's listening is going to be some diehard apologetic fan. I need to keep this accessible and lay level. And I don't think that's a bad practice to have generally, actually. And secondly, actually, there's still something in many people's minds that makes them think, well, radio is still the kind of serious kind of media. And therefore, it sometimes means I've been able to attract guests I might not have been able to attract if it was just a podcast, let's say. Even though, actually, I think podcasting probably is the future in many ways, and that radio is adapting to that reality. It's an interesting place at the moment. I'm glad that I can do both, the best of both worlds, hopefully.
Is it hard to pull off a show like yours in the UK?
Well, our radio station is somewhat unique in the UK. We are one of the only Christian radio stations in the UK. There are sort of faith debate programs of a sort that exist on the BBC and places like that, but they don't tend to deal with a more kind of evangelical perspective that we tend to have represented on the show from the Christian point of view. And they tend to be, they don't really delve quite into the same kind of areas with the same kind of depth that we try to get to in my show. And so I think just because it's somewhat unique on a unique radio station, it's sort of carved out its own niche. And that means it's been, you know, relatively successful, really. I mean, in terms of the general landscape of the UK, it's a fairly secular country, obviously. But in a way, the fact that the show itself deals with that interaction between the secular world and the Christian world has kind of helped actually to mean that we can reach a wider audience than we might otherwise if it was just Christians talking together, if you see what I mean.
Sure. And if you were having a conversation, let's say on Islam, how would you have to frame it to be able to air it in the UK?
Okay. So obviously, as a radio program, we have to stick within certain guidelines. There is a sort of radio authority in the UK that will respond to complaints if complaints are made against a particular broadcast. And so there's a kind of code of broadcasting that we have to abide by. But because by its nature, the program is a dialogical one where we have both sides represented, it means people can be pretty forthright and critique the other side, whether, you know, it's a Christian critiquing a Muslim or vice versa, because there's a right of reply. That's the important thing that the guidelines state for radio broadcasting, that there has to be the ability for the other side to be aired. And that's exactly what the show does. So, you know, I never worry too much about exactly what gets said. Obviously, there are certain limits, you know, bad language is not allowed at the time that we broadcast the show, but then I wouldn't really want bad language on my show anyway. And so generally speaking, we don't tend to run, we're not particularly limited by the fact it is a British radio broadcast as well as a podcast. Obviously, the main limitation of doing radio is time. You only have a specific, you know, length of time on a particular slot on the schedule, whereas podcasting, obviously, you know, you can go as long as you like if you think the audience will want it. So I sometimes do a sort of a longer version on the podcast and a bit of a scaled back version on the radio. If the conversation has been too good to kind of stop, I let it carry on and know that the podcast audience will get the longer version, if you like.
Yeah. You know, before I get into how you started doing the show, I was very interested as I read through your book about how your wife, Lucy, and you, when you were married, spent a year working with the Odibo mission in Namibia. I think that's on the southwest coast of Africa. That seems to be a really influential time in your life. It sort of set the tone for what you're doing now.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, certainly all of those experiences were quite influential. So Lucy and I got married sort of fairly soon after leaving university. We met at Oxford. She had studied theology. I had done politics, philosophy, and economics. And before we settled into married life and careers and that kind of thing, we thought we'd love to go somewhere, do something that we might not have the opportunity to do otherwise. And that took us to Namibia, working on a kind of rural Anglican mission station with a hospital, a school, and a church, and really just settling in and doing life with the people there for about 8 months. We made great friends. We really got to know the people. And we were able to teach and be involved with the church there and just have some wonderful experiences, cross-cultural ministry. And really, yeah, I guess it opened our eyes, as did other experiences we had actually working among multicultural congregations in London, for instance, of the fact that Christianity is a diverse faith. And it's great to see the way it is expressed and lived in all kinds of different cultures. It reminded me and has stayed with me of the fact that the reason Christianity has gone around the world is because it is not, as some other religions are, culturally located in that sense. It is the kind of faith which bends and adapts to every culture, even with those core truths still being the same. And for me, that was sort of evidenced by our time in Namibia, where I saw the transformative effect of Christianity on the culture there. And that was great to be able to witness.
And you also, I'm sure, saw the transformative impact of having conversations. As you just pointed out, listening to another point of view from another culture, from people that don't have an orientation that you grew up with, those conversations are now emblematic of what you do on the show, it seems.
Absolutely, yeah. And certainly, I think every conversation I've had in that sort of very formative time in the gap year we took before coming back to the UK, at university as well, where I inevitably crossed paths with many people of different worldviews and perspectives, they all helped to shape what I would be doing later on the show. And in many ways, even my wife, you know, when I met her, she came from a very different Christian tradition to me when we met. And we had to work that out between us. We weren't sure initially whether this was going to work between us because, you know, we had some fairly different views about church and about some aspects of theology. But I think actually those conversations and the way that we sort of found the best in each other's perspectives did help to help me to then have conversations later on where we're not just seeking to dismantle other people, but we're trying to truly understand where they're coming from. And I think that probably has helped in my own ability to hopefully moderate these debates in a fruitful kind of way.
Yeah, something you talk about in the book is we get stuck in our own linguistic hall of mirrors, our own echo chamber, what I like to call a psycho-epistemological cocoons. We get stuck and we can't really understand other arguments because we're only listening to the arguments from people that have our perspective. And your show really breaks that mold.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that Christians who listen will better understand where the atheist, agnostic, Muslim, whoever is coming from. They will obviously hopefully hear a good reasoned defense of Christianity. But I don't think they'll only hear that. They will hopefully hear some of the things that maybe a non-believer finds irritating or disrespectful or illogical about Christianity. And that may well help them to reframe and rethink the way that they carry their faith themselves. And equally, my hope, of course, is that non-believers, atheists, agnostics, or other faiths will hear from the Christian representative something that perhaps helps them to reframe and rethink what the other side are doing. I rarely find that, I mean, you know, it's not that every atheist who listens becomes a Christian, not by any length, but most people who come along to the show as sort of pretty hard-boiled atheists, if they stick with the show, in general, I find at the very least, they will say, well, I may not be convinced yet, Justin, but at least it's challenged my preconception that Christians are just, you know, airheaded people who believe in fairy tales. I don't think you can listen to that many editions of the show and come away with that misconception of Christianity, which I think is a good thing.
How did you get involved in doing this show in the first place?
Well, I'd been working for a few years at Premier Christian Radio in the UK, and I'd learned the basics of broadcasting, interviewing, and I was kind of itching to get my own spot in the schedule. And so I just came up with this idea. I thought we're really good as a radio station at talking to Christians about Christian things, equipping Christians in their personal lives and so on. But I didn't feel like we were really breaking out of that Christian bubble too much. And the fact is that most of the Christians that we were broadcasting to lived among secular neighbors and family and work colleagues. And so I wanted to create a spot in our schedule where we could model the kinds of conversations that they might be having to have with people around them. And that was where Unbelievable was born, Unbelievable with a question mark, because we're simply asking, are the claims of Christianity unbelievable or are they not? And I hoped that by having a sort of space, you know, an hour and a half on a Saturday afternoon, we would give Christians who were listening the tools to start to have those kinds of conversations. It was a little bit experimental. And to be honest, you know, we did get some complaints to begin with because some people didn't like hearing atheist voices on their Christian radio station, quite understandably. But there were lots who did, who really understood the mission of the program. And to his credit, our CEO, the station manager, said, no, we're going to stick with this. And I think this is worth it. And yeah, you know, 12, nearly 13 years, in fact, later, Unbelievable, still going strong. And what we didn't see was the way it would explode really as a podcast and actually start to acquire a lot of non-Christians listening to it as well. And that, as I say, has been very exciting.
What's exciting to me as I read through your book is the art of having a good conversation. I mean, this is applicable to everybody. And I think you have some great insights on that art. It's an art and a science. I mean, there's some rules apply, but the more you do it, the better you get at it. So talk about the art and science of having good conversations.
Yeah, I think it is something where, in all honesty, practice is what makes it happen. You know, there are some things you can learn with theory, but there are some things you have to do to really learn how to do it. And I think having conversations is one of those. I think you have to be obviously open to hearing the other side. You know, a conversation is not a conversation unless you're genuinely listening and trying to understand the other person's perspective. I think integrity is very important as well. Being willing to admit when you don't have an answer. I mean, the worst thing I see is when Christians try to claim knowledge that they simply don't have and end up digging themselves an awfully great hole in the process. Because people can smell it when you're just trying to win an argument from a mile off. And while I'm, you know, I think there is a place for that debate, for the kind of sort of more point scoring type of strategic debate, there can be some value in that. I think generally people are more interested in hearing genuine conversations rather than hearing a kind of a point scoring exercise. And that's why in general, I'm increasingly finding even on public stages where I'm invited to moderate discussions and debates, less and less are people setting up kind of the formal debate that you might have seen, you know, 10, 20 years ago. People are much more interested in actually just having a sit down conversation. And I think you've seen that in some pretty interesting cases of in the secular sphere, you know, with Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris did a big tour where it was just the two of them sitting in these massive auditoriums with huge audiences. They just had a conversation for an hour and a half and loads of people turned out for it. I think people are engaged by intellectually stimulating conversation on some of the biggest issues by good thinkers. And so that's kind of what we've been trying to do in our little corner of the internet and the broadcasting world. Try to model what that would look like when you have a good conversation.
I really like what you just said, in essence, about humility. So you don't know the answer to our question. And I mean, we're all limited in time and space. We can't know everything there is to know about everything. Certainly I don't, after having done the Bible Answer Man broadcast for over 30 years. So you have to, at times, have the humility to say, you know, I don't know what the answer to that question is. And then you research in return. And I do think that gives you a lot of credibility, but I think even more from a practical standpoint, what that allows you to do is find out what that answer is. So next time you do have a well-reasoned answer to a question you didn't have any fix on before.
Yeah. And it actually gives you the opportunity to keep the conversation going, actually. I think, you know, saying, I don't know, but hey, I'll go and try and find out, let's talk again, is a great answer to give someone if you're in that kind of a situation. Because at the end of the day, yeah, a conversation is one where you should be willing to grow and learn in the process, as well as the other person hopefully being in that position as well. So I have learned so much in the conversations I've had the privilege of moderating. You know, I could only write the book that I wrote because I had that opportunity to sit and listen to people on both sides having these fantastic conversations. And so I think that's probably what a lot of people get from listening to Unbelievable. They come away with a much greater understanding of the issues and also the kind of people who are involved in putting them across and how to best make the case if they're wanting to make a case in one direction or the other. It's not just about having the facts. It's about the way you hold yourself when you're making that case as well.
By the way, you are a terrific writer. How did you learn the art of writing?
That's very kind of you to say.
That's true. It's a very interesting read. When I first saw the book, I got to tell you, the first thing I thought is, you know, same old, same old. I've heard, you know, all these apologetic arguments, and you know, I've seen dozens and dozens of books, and they reworked them a little bit. But this is a really interesting read.
That's extremely kind. Thank you. I'm fortunate to have, as I say, a wealth of these interesting conversations to draw on to illustrate the book. I've also been fortunate. My career with Premier, which is more than just a radio station, it also encompasses websites, video, and magazines as well. Well, that included 4 years editing Premier Christianity magazine, which is kind of the UK equivalent of Christianity Today in the USA. It's a non-denominational magazine aimed at Christians in the UK and beyond. I was writing for them for several years before that as well. And so it was really in the process of really writing as a journalist regularly for the magazine that I started to develop my skills under a very good editor at the time, Ruth Mawinney. I then went on to become the editor after she moved on for 4 years. And again, that was very good. I was doing a lot of writing during that time, editing other people's writing, which I think helps to develop your own creativity and thinking as well. And so by the time I sat down to write the book, I had an awful lot of articles I'd written myself on some of these issues to draw upon as kind of source material, if you like. And writing magazine articles does teach you the art of being concise, trying to make sure you engage people's attention from the first paragraph. And it's quite a good exercise, actually, in simply writing chapters. Every chapter I kind of treated like a lengthy article, and I sort of applied the same sort of principles that I do to my magazine articles. And I knew that I was writing for probably a similar kind of person as I was writing for in the magazine. And so for me, there was a very natural step from editing and writing articles in that magazine to writing this book. So I think that will help.
I kind of like the story of you and Lucy and how you posit that. And then the unpredictable sentence, oh, and reader, I married her.
I'm borrowing a line from Jane Austen there, obviously. And there's a sense in which it's just a fun little, yeah. I think humor is good in writing. I think these days, you could write an apologetics book that's terribly serious and po-faced. I think it's good to just throw in some levity. Otherwise, you know, these rather serious topics can become, you know, a little bogged down, and it's always good to lighten the atmosphere occasionally, I think.
I've seen a lot of people moderate debates, and let's say there's a Christian moderating a debate between another Christian and an atheist. Oftentimes what you have is two against one. How do you moderate debates? Do you moderate them in an even-handed fashion, or do you weigh in with your own perspective?
I apologize. My phone is going off in the background, Hank, but I'll press
good.
On.
I love it because that it's like my kids screaming in the background. I have 12 kids, and you know when they were growing up and I was doing broadcasts, you'd hear kids in the background.
Well, this is as you mentioned, my wife is a minister of a church, and so we're a busy church house, and there's always comings and goings. But I've managed to find what I thought was a quiet room to have this conversation, but I had forgotten the phone. But anyway, the question was, what was the question again? How do I moderate my debates and try to keep neutral? I think I've just, for whatever reason, although a lot of other people say, oh, if I was in that chair, Justin, I'd have terrible trouble not kind of coming back at the atheist or whoever. I don't know. I just seem to have been given a character that can be quite calm in those sorts of situations. A certain amount of equanimity is needed in order to facilitate these kinds of discussions. And I think I'm very aware that there's both Christians and atheists listening, and that I'm not there. The guests are there to make the case. I'm there to facilitate the discussion. I'm not there to gang up on either side. That's not to say I don't sometimes come in on one side or the other. If I feel, say, one side is having a lot of the upper hand, I might, you know, come in on the other side just to put a point back. But I'll try to do that in a way that hopefully gets the best out of the debate. I hope that at least not too often my own prejudices or biases don't too often influence things. That said, I'm as human as the next person, and there are inevitably going to be times when my own feelings or thoughts color the way the conversation goes and the kinds of angles I want to take it down inevitably. One of my favorite apologetic arguments for God is the moral argument, which you mentioned some issues around at the beginning of the program. And one of the things that most likely you'll hear me probably weighing in myself with and starting to get involved in the conversation is if I hear an atheist, for instance, who doesn't believe in objective morality, using a lot of moral language about how you ought to believe this and things shouldn't be this way. And that's the point where I will quite often step in and say, hang on a minute. How are you helping yourself to all these oughts and shoulds if there is no, you know, objective moral standard to which we are beholden? Because I often feel that is one area where there's a glaring contradiction in many atheists that I meet. They haven't really thought that through. And if there's any one issue that I sometimes will press in on an atheist with, it's sometimes that moral issue.
We have a famous atheist in the U.S. He's a professor at Duke University. He's a professor of philosophy as well as an author, and he wrote a very, very famous book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality. But his name, Alex Rosenberg, What he does is he bites the bullet on the moral issue. He just says flat out, there is no right or wrong. There is no good or bad. And so he is consistent with his own atheism. But as you pointed out, most atheists are not.
Yeah. And I have respect for people who, as you say, bite the bullet, who realize the consequences of their materialism. And for me, I respect that. I think, okay, at least you've owned up to it, even though it goes against every moral fiber in most people's being, you know, the idea that there really isn't any right or wrong, that actually the actions of Hitler are just his opinion, his way of living his life, that there's no moral reality to the universe that screams out, that is not the way you should conduct yourself. Equally, I find it refreshing as well when I sometimes do meet atheists who do believe in objective morality and say so and try to defend it. And I've met both. It's the ones who are trying to have their cake and eat it that sort of I feel like, well, you've got to understand the implications of what you're arguing here. I mean, one atheist I met recently, actually, who does hold, it turns out, to objective morality is Peter Singer. Now, Peter Singer is well known as a controversial moral philosopher at Princeton University. He's Australian and he lectures around the world. He was on the final edition of a recent series we've had within the Unbelievable show called The Big Conversation. It's a special series of video debates. And I had him on with a Christian thinker called Andy Bannister. We were debating the whole moral argument. Do we need God to be good? Human dignity, human rights. It was interesting because Peter Singer is a utilitarian. So he has an ethical framework. He believes that it's all about achieving the greatest possible well-being. And he counts all kinds of living creatures as having that kind of value. And that leads to some interesting moral conclusions on his part, whereby, for instance, in a thought experiment, you may be better off saving a burning barn of 50 pigs to saving an infant in a similar fire situation, because he sees that any kind of conscious activity and ability to have preferences and feel pleasure and pain and so on are true of any creature, not just humans. And so that was a really interesting conversation because most people instinctively, intuitively feel human life is somehow sacred, precious. But Singer kind of doesn't. And he's willing to defend that. And interestingly, as I mentioned, he also does believe in the objectivity of moral values. He said he'd come to that decision that there is a realm of what really is right and wrong, what we should and shouldn't do. And we pressed him, Andy and I, on, well, does that not negate your materialist view as an atheist? Does it not point towards God as a transcendent source of these moral values? And his view was, well, it is mysterious, but he felt that other objections against God, such as the problem of suffering and evil, meant that God was not a satisfactory explanation for the existence of those moral values, which I felt, okay, that's one way of dealing with it. But it still felt like there was a gaping mystery within his materialism about just how there happens to be this realm of objective moral values and duties that exist seemingly out of the blue. Well, who knows? As Andy said, the door is possibly open. You know, if we can perhaps persuade him of some of his other problems with God, God might just be the explanation for this realm of objective moral values that he apparently does believe in.
Another atheist you had an opportunity to interview, Richard Dawkins, and I love the way you tell the story in the book, how you found yourself walking next to him as he was walking alongside a bike, and you had the opportunity later on to interview him, and then beyond that, to interview him again. Talk about what it was like to interview perhaps the most well-known atheist on the planet today.
Yeah, in a way, the show sort of began around the time that Richard Dawkins was really coming to be best known for his atheistic work. The God Delusion, his best-selling atheist work, was published less than a year after the show began. And so in many ways, that became, you know, something that was frequently mentioned on the show, Richard Dawkins or the God Delusion. I'd wanted to have him on for a few years after the show got going, but I'd never been able to catch him, as it were. And then he was due to be having a debate at Oxford with John Lennox, who's a well-known Christian thinker here in the UK. And they were going to be debating the God question at the Natural History Museum at Oxford University. And I was able to go along and watch that debate. I had a press pass, so I got to attend the sort of press briefing afterwards. And I'd been invited to go to the after party at a nearby college. And so I thought, okay, well, maybe this will be my chance. Maybe I'll be able to bag a quick interview with him. I had my handheld recorder with me at the time. So I left the Natural History Museum, started walking down the road towards the college where the after-show party was. And who should pull up next to me, pushing his bike along, but Richard Dawkins, as you say, himself. And that's, you know, that's the way he gets around in Oxford, by bike. So in that sense, it wasn't completely unexpected that he might have been in the vicinity, but it was still, you know, nice that we managed to share some time together before we got to this party. And I explained who I was and who I worked for. And he was a little, skeptical of the whole idea of a Christian radio station. But nonetheless, he said, yes, well, I'll be happy to talk to you once we get inside. And indeed, what transpired was I was able to get sort of 10 or 15 minutes with him. It was a busy sort of hubbub of a party with the canapes and the wine going round, but I did sort of, you know, manage to get that 10 minutes and just ask him some key questions that came out of that debate. And yeah, we had a very interesting conversation, part of which actually was then relayed by a lot of different blogs and others, because he made some interesting admissions related to the moral argument in that particular conversation. So it was a good chance to be able to talk to the man I'd been chasing for so long.
Talk about the key to connecting. I mean, obviously you're connecting with your audience, but for people in general, what would be your keys to connecting with people in conversations?
I think knowing something about that person, their background, if they, you know, have written or researched in a particular area, familiarizing yourself with some of that, knowing how that connects with your worldview is always helpful, so that you sort of know where to go to begin with. I think, unfortunately, a lot of the time, if we're not prepared in those sorts of situations, we can end up talking past each other because we may not simply understand the terms we're using. We may not have a good enough grasp of where that person is coming from in some ways. So I, certainly when I'm preparing to host a conversation or have a conversation with someone, I'd like to do a little background research and make sure that I'm at least at some level familiar with where they're coming from. And I think inevitably, the character of an individual makes a big difference as to what kind of a conversation you will end up having with them. And so I think it's always good to be ready to, I suppose, try to meet that person's personality in a way that is helpful. And if inevitably the person, say, you're speaking to is, you know, a fairly prickly person who tends to lodge lots of objections and is maybe quite snarky in the way they come across or whatever, you may want to consider how fruitful having a conversation with a person like that is going to be in the long run, whether you're actually just going to be dragged down into, you know, a lot more heat than light in that kind of a conversation, and whether you're the right person to be having that sort of a conversation. Sometimes I hear conversations that had a lot of promise in them, but they kind of get dragged aside by people behaving badly, frankly, you know, and that's always sad when you see things get derailed in that kind of a way. But I think where both sides can kind of agree, a certain code of conduct, I suppose, and where you can encourage an atmosphere of disagreeing agreeably, then I think you're in a better position. In my experience, simply getting people face to face does a lot of the work on that front. I think we live in an age where people have gotten used to sort of getting pretty direct and nasty online. People seem to have forgotten their manners a lot of the time when it comes to online debates on social media and so on. I tend to find that a lot of the heat gets taken out if you just get people face to face. People seem less willing to say some of those things face to face than they do behind the safety of a keyboard. And that alone, I think, is part of the value of having face to face conversations as I try to model on the show each week.
I'm really happy that you said that. That's such an important point. I mean, you get people face to face and everything changes. And so often in the age in which internet lies travel halfway around the world before truth has had the chance to put its boots on, you have people making these snarky remarks and these dishonest remarks that they would never make if they were actually face to face with the person. I want to talk about something else, and it's related to that. It's the hunger that people have today for authentic conversations, conversations that are not rigged, they're not predetermined, they're actually authentic. And you talk about the importance of that in an age of fake news and fake tans and fake spirituality. I thought it'd be fun for you to elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. I think these days, especially our young people, they're growing up often in an atmosphere where they're being taught things through a conversational, dialogical kind of way. And I think very quickly they can see through anything that's artificial or where it's simply rigged in one direction or another. And I think there is a problem sometimes with certain parts of the Christian church and certain parts of, you know, the apologetics world, where if everything comes a bit too tidy and a bit too wrapped up in a neat bow, it's going to make people think, it's not that simple. It's not that easy. And I think you have to accept that these issues are very often difficult, and there are grey areas, and you know, things are not always that simple to work out. And I think having the conversation means that you get to see some of the nuance of that, some of the mystery that does exist, some of the questions that remain on the table by the end of a conversation. And I think that's authentic in the sense that that reflects real life. People feel, actually, I've listened to something which is true, in the sense that I heard a real conversation there. I heard two people trying to make best sense of the world around them from their different worldviews. And that's what I would see as being the authenticity of the conversation. I think people also see through when somebody is just there to win an argument. I think people know that, can sense when someone isn't genuinely there to learn and to engage, because that often just comes across in, you know, if you feel like someone is just hammering another person without really being willing to listen to their point of view, then I think people see that as an artificial kind of dialogue. It's not true to life. And I think people just appreciate feeling like they've heard a meeting of minds at the end of the day. And that's not to say that every show of mine perfectly represents that kind of tenor of conversation. There are shows where, frankly, it is more combative, and there are people who are out to win an argument. And that's just the nature of it. You know, you do this many shows over this many years, you'll get a whole variety of characters. But I think the most engaging ones tend to be where people get a little bit beyond just the intellectual, more abstract arguments, and you really get to know the person a bit more, and you get to feel like, I really met and felt like someone told me something about themselves in that particular dialogue. And those are when you really get to the heart of the issues very often.
Yeah, I want you to expand on that, because it's such a critical point. So you look at the atheist in your debate, and for you, he's not just a pawn in your particular game. He's an icon of God. He's someone that's created in the Imago Dei. He's someone that is important just because he is a human being that carries the imprimatur of God. And to treat people like that, I think, is the quintessence of what Christianity ought to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's absolutely essential that we treat people as ends in themselves, not simply as a means to an end of, you know, defeating someone in an intellectual battle, let's say. And for that purpose, I think you do have to treat people seriously and be willing to have these conversations in a spirit of love and grace and a willingness to be open and to be corrected. And I often, the challenge I sometimes give to people who maybe go a bit too far in sort of constantly trying to win arguments and debate people for the sake of winning an argument, is, would you be as willing to spend as much time praying for that person as you're willing to spend debating them on that online forum or wherever it is? And that puts a check in my spirit, in the sense that I have to ask myself, what is the purpose of this? You know, do I genuinely see this person as precious and important to God, or do I see this person as, you know, a way of furthering my own ends and, you know, winning some kind of an intellectual battle? And I think it's really important, if we're going to have integrity in our walk and in the things we do, that we make sure we're doing things for the right reason. It's so easy, as I'm sure you're aware, Hank, for apologetics to become a kind of idol in itself. You know, we rely on our intellectual ability and our arguments and everything else, and actually forget that ultimately it all rests on the grace of God, and we're not ultimately in the driving seat ourselves.
We've mentioned that word apologetics a number of times. I want to drill a little deeper with respect to that word. I often talk about apologetics as pre-evangelism, God using our well-reasoned answer as a springboard or an opportunity to share the grace, the truth, the love that only Jesus Christ can bring to the human heart. But it's also post-evangelism. What I mean by that is, when the winds and waves of doubt beat upon the house of your faith, you have these pillars or posts that you can cling to. God created the universe. Jesus Christ is God. Demonstrate that he's God through the immutable fact of resurrection. The Bible's divine as opposed to merely human in origin. It corresponds to reality. So apologetics is not only just winning arguments, but it's also solidifying your own faith. And the reason that I bring this up in the context of this discussion is, you yourself had a fledgling faith as you went to university, and going to university cast some doubts on the Christian faith, and this is where apologetics came to the rescue.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, mine is probably a very typical story in that respect. I think all Christians go through seasons of doubt at some point in their lives. And yeah, probably the most significant one for me was not long after being at university, having grown up in a Christian context, having come to faith really myself in my late teens, through something that was quite experiential, really, a real awareness of God that kind of took hold of me. It was only really when I got to university that people seriously started to intellectually question my faith. And I went through a period of really questioning the whole thing and asking, well, have I just, you know, was this all just an experience, you know, in my head? Nothing in solid reality, as it were. And I think that is where apologetics can be incredibly helpful in the right context. I think because Christianity is a faith that is based in a real place, a real time, a real person, Jesus Christ. And that, as you say, gives you an anchor point in history, in reality. And once you discover, I think, as I began to discover through writers like C.S. Lewis and others, the rich tradition of Christian thinking and intellectual activity. And I think ultimately seeing, especially, you know, with the benefit of hindsight of over 10 years of doing the radio show and podcast, that we're all looking at the world through a certain worldview, whether we know it or not, and that actually we're all called to give an account of that. At the end of the day, we all have faith in something. And the question is, which of our worldviews best correspond to the data that is open to all of us? And what I've tried to do with the book is explain why that experience I had of the love of Christ was confirmed by the evidence that I then went and aim to explore. And I believe that the evidence from science, from our experience of human value and morality, of purpose, of the history of Scripture and the evidence for the resurrection, I think builds a compelling case that God and God in Christ specifically is the best explanation of this wide variety of data. And that atheism struggles to explain many of the things that we see around us. And so for me, the winning combination, if you like, is when the head and the heart come together in that way. I began my Christian faith as an experience of the heart, and then I discovered there was also this rich intellectual tradition that also goes hand in hand with it. And I think one without the other, if we're all intellect and no experience, or all the experience and no intellect, we rob ourselves of something very important. But when we bring them together, you have something very powerful and something that can speak to others as well.
Yeah, it reminds me of the title of a book I'm writing right now, Truth Matters, Life Matters More. So I spent my career defining truth, debating truth, defending truth. But I came to find out as I traveled the world that I hadn't had an experience with truth in the truest sense that many people that I was encountering in places that they wouldn't have had the kind of background that I did. And yet they had this existential experience with God. And so I began to realize that the map is not the territory. The menu is not the meal. The menu is not nutritious. It points you to the meal. And so I came at it in an intellectual way and had to learn that life matters more, that we can have an encounter with the ineffable God, that we can be brought in to the fellowship of the Trinity, that we can experience the uncreated energies of God.
Yeah, and I think we all need to find that place of humility where we realize that actually God is bigger than our particular way of perceiving him. And for some people, the intellectual journey is very important. And I meet many people, especially in the area that I work in, apologetics and theology, for whom that is essential. But I rarely find people for whom that's the only thing that brought them there. There's usually a heart journey, if you like, a journey of the heart going on as well. And indeed, people who meet God in many different ways. And it can be arrogant of us to assume that our way is the only way of coming to know and understand God.
You sort of alluded to this already, but cash this out a little bit more for us. How is doubt an inevitable part of making sense of a person's worldview?
Well, I think in our own journey, doubt is an inevitable part of the journey, because anyone who is wired to be rational and to think things through is going to knock up against issues of one kind or another. None of us, I think, are insulated from, as Christians certainly, from doubt. And I think, you know, even atheists, I think, have their moments of doubt where they question their own worldview and some of the things behind it. So, yeah, I suppose the problem is that very often doubt, I think, is seen as the enemy of faith somehow. And I just don't think it is. I think that faith kind of goes hand in hand with doubt for a lot of people. And faith is more often, it's simply very often about trusting the God we do know in the midst of the things we don't know, the doubts that we have. And for me, I don't see it as somehow the enemy of faith. And that was, I've had some really interesting conversations just recently about doubt. I had a really interesting pastor called Austin Fisher, who's written a book on doubt recently on the program, who has had gone through, you know, his own journey of struggling with intellectual issues and so on, and come to a place where he's found a place where he can resolve that. And we had an ex-Christian on who went through a period of doubt, which led to him losing his faith. And I appreciated both their stories. I found them both were trying to get at the truth. And for whatever reason, I find myself that I've never come across a doubt that has crippled me in that sense. I've always found that the Christian faith, a particular way of looking at the Christian faith that I perhaps thought was somehow could only be seen this way. It turns out there are different ways of looking at issues that help us to realize that actually some of the things that we think are problems turn out not to be problems. And so for me, if you like, although mysteries remain, although doubts of one kind or another are always possible, for me, there's a story, there's a truth, there's a beauty at the heart of the Christian faith, which for me, I find utterly compelling. That's not to say that I will never have doubts, of course, but it is to say that the thing I see at the center is bright enough to kind of put those shadows to the side. They don't encroach in the way that they obviously have for other people who have not been able to sustain a faith for whatever reason.
Has there been an evolution in your own thinking as a result of doing your broadcast and your podcast?
Oh, for sure. I mean, doubtlessly. I mean, there are many things that I now have thought through and maybe taken a position on that I didn't even have opportunity to have thought about before the show. You know, there's a sense in which inevitably by hosting a show in which you're turning over issues and critically assessing them with different points of view, you inevitably will start to reframe and question and start to look at some of your own beliefs. I mean, I could just to pick one example. So I would probably have broadly speaking characterize myself as someone who believed in eternal conscious torment as a view of hell when I began the program. But through conversations and reading and hosting debates on the subject, I would now characterize myself really as an annihilationist point of view when it comes to those who choose to reject God. That's, in my view, actually having looked at both sides of this argument and hosted some, you know, well-versed speakers on both sides, is the biblical and philosophically most tenable view of the fate of those who do reject Christ. But that doesn't stop me fully appreciating people who don't take that view, who disagree. I don't see it as in any way a, you know, an issue that is in that sense primary in Christianity. I think there are a certain number of issues which we can simply say we will have differences of opinion on these, but it doesn't stop us affirming the core truths of Christianity. And so, yeah, that would be one example where I'd say my thinking has definitely undergone a change over time. But there are many other places where it's just understanding something more deeply or better, I think. Scripture, for instance. I think once you begin to understand just something as simple as the nature of the genre of biography that the gospel writers were using and understanding it in their terms and the way that things were written to that culture and in that time, it helps to undo a lot of the often somewhat facile, honestly, objections that are often raised against scripture, because you realize we're not supposed to be judging this as we would a sort of modern 21st century news report or something like that. And all of that, I think, helps to get behind some of the issues that are often characterized as problems for Christianity, just in terms of helping to understand and to then integrate them into a more fully fledged and thought through faith.
You know, I think it is important to learn to read the Bible in the sense in which it's intended, or to become adept at the art and science of biblical interpretation. I also recognize that there have been some prodigious intellects that have weighed in on the subject of annihilationism. I remember interviewing John Stott before he died, and that was his position. But I can't get past common sense. I think common sense dictates that a God of love, that a God of justice, doesn't arbitrarily annihilate the crowning jewels of his creation. He doesn't rub them out. I think he graciously provides them the freedom to choose between redemption and rebellion in this life and in the life to come. And I think it would be a horrific evil to think that God would create people with freedom of choice and then annihilate them because of their choices. And I say this because I don't think that non-existence is better than any kind of existence, because non-existence is nothing at all. So I have a real hard time with annihilationism, and I think it does go against the weight of church history. And this is one of my, you know, pet peeves, I suppose. I have had to become very, very humble in my own assessments on certain dogmas. For example, for many, many years, I didn't believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But then after studying church history, I thought, who am I in the 21st century to go against the weight of 16 centuries of church history, all the way through Luther believing in the real presence of Christ? So I think there has to be a certain humility with people in the 21st century to say, boy, if I'm going to come up with a new dogma or a dogma that was roundly rejected in the church councils, I better be very, very careful about it.
Yeah, and obviously I don't want to get us into a big debate on the annihilationist question, but no,
well, I don't want to debate you on anything, because I'll probably lose.
The feeling is mutual. I suspect I would be on the losing end. But I mean, in all honesty, yeah, and for me, as I say, I'm happy to say that is your view, Hank, and I'm sure a very defensible case can be made for it. It's not where I've landed up, but I'm always willing to have my ideas challenged and
I love that part of it. I love what you just said. You know, because the problem is people come to certain conclusions and then they close their mind and then they repeat the same mantra over and over again, as opposed to be willing to discuss it. This is probably not the time or place to do it, but I love what you just said.
Yeah, and I mean it honestly. You know, I hope that I do have the humility to say no issue is ever fully case closed for me, because I always want to be open to hearing and reassessing my own take on these issues. But yeah, as I say, that's just one example probably of where my thinking has changed over the years. In a sense, though, I think that there's that phrase, isn't there, that Christianity is simple enough to be understood by a child and deep enough for mystics and sages to spend their whole life wading in its depths. And for me, that's been true of my journey with Christianity. It's at one level, it's simple and compelling. On the other hand, it constantly holds out extraordinary, deep truths that you could spend your whole life examining. And I'm just very fortunate to have a career, a ministry in which I get to delve into these questions on a regular basis.
Yeah, truths that you can apprehend, but you can't fully comprehend. You also have gone through an evolution in your thinking with respect to creation and evolution. Can you cash that out a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, I wouldn't say it was something that was particularly fully resolved one way or the other when I began the show. It was really through having conversations with people from a variety of perspectives that started to change my own thinking on the subject. I respect a lot of people who do take a theistic evolutionary perspective on things, and I can fully see why there are strong arguments for seeing that kind of, you know, looking at it through that lens of a God who creates through that process. And I think there are ways of reconciling aspects of scripture with it. I would say I've come to a point of view where I can't reconcile myself to a strict young earth creationist perspective. I'm always willing to have those discussions and debates on the show. And we do, you know, have various different perspectives, including young earth, on the program. But for me, I've found myself more in tune with an old Earth sort of view, that there simply is a record of the Earth being old, and that the nature of Genesis, those early chapters especially, doesn't specify that they have to be read in a way that involves necessarily a 24-hour, seven-day creation, and that there's room for understanding those aspects differently. I mean, overall, I would say that, especially when you're dealing with the early chapters of Genesis, you're dealing with a genre which isn't necessarily meant to be understood in the kind of historical terms that you get from the emergence of say, Abraham, you know, where we're obviously dealing then with a character that's meant to be understood as historical. I think those early chapters are dealing more with the why questions of who we are in relation to God and creation, rather than the exact how, the scientific questions, if you like, of exactly how things came to be. And so for me, I would see that there is, however, interesting evidence for the uniqueness of humans within the creation. And so if I'm completely honest with you, Hank, it's not something where I would say I've come to a very strict conclusion. I can see value in some accounts where there's a sort of the dawning of consciousness and a moral sense within humanity. I can also see, you know, a good case to be made for the special creation of humans as people who bore the image of God and were, in that sense, you know, the first truly divine, if you like, inspired bearers of the Imago Dei. And for me, I'm very happy, in a sense, to not necessarily know exactly where I fall on that sort of spectrum, if you like. It's never been something where I feel masses of theological weight hangs on the question for me. Again, I'm happy to be proved wrong on that, but it's not something where I feel like there's a very strict line has to be drawn on exactly where you see that specifically happening.
Yeah, I don't think we need to get a debate on this, but I would tell you this from my perspective. First of all, I think you're absolutely right when it comes to the book of Genesis. I don't think that Genesis is meant to give us a chronology. It's meant to give us a hierarchy of creation culminating in the crowning jewels of God's creation, humankind. And if you want to find out how old the universe is, I think you have to look at the book of nature. The Bible, and particularly the first few chapters of Genesis, are not chronological by chirological. They are God's purposes in creating. But as far as Adam and Eve is concerned, I think that all you have to do is look at the Lord's words in that regard, that the Creator made them male and female, and you can't allegorize the words of the Lord, because Jesus further affirmed a historical Adam and Eve when he referred to the murder of their son Abel. And not only that, but you have Luke, who was writing primarily to a Gentile audience that extends his genealogy past Abraham to the first Adam. And thus he highlighted Christ, the second Adam, as the Savior of all humanity. And if that's insufficient, you can look at other historical records like Chronicles or the like. So I think it's true that if you look at the book of Genesis, Genesis is a historical narrative. It's interlaced with Jewish poetry, but it's hardly an allegory when it comes to Adam and Eve. And I personally, just for the record, I think that theistic evolution is the worst of all possibilities. If you want to believe in evolution, fine, but don't blame God for it. So I think it's the most cruel, inefficient way of producing life. But having said that, I mean, that's a subject for another discussion. But what I like most about this conversation is that there's an openness to dialogue as opposed to being stuck in your own paradigm. And yeah. I think, you know, the problem with paradigms is paradigms only allow you to see what paradigms allow you to see. So we don't think as much about our paradigms oftentimes as we think with our paradigms, and therefore we don't listen to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, for me, in a sense, I'm happy for, you know, very often the creation evolution thing is something I do regard as, again, as a secondary issue. I don't believe that Christians should be splitting or, you know, having fights with each other in that sense. We can disagree and we can have good reasons for disagreeing, you know, where we may stand on these particular issues. But for me, they're not primary, personally, in the way that the deity of Christ is, in the way that the resurrection is. in the way that Trinitarian theology is. These are, in a sense, I think, you know, C.S. Lewis was right to speak of a mere Christianity, the kind of the basics upon which our faith is founded. And I'm willing to hear and understand and try to learn from a variety of different perspectives that may have different, you know, views on where we land in terms of Genesis and what it's meant to be saying to us and so on. I mean, the view you just expounded, I think, Hank, is an excellent one, and one that I'm in large degree very, very sympathetic to. And I think that the challenge for every Christian is to take the Bible seriously, and seriously enough to recognize the literature that is involved there. I think there has been an unfortunate sense in which some people have tried to flatten the text in a way that it was never meant to be, so that they take everything in exactly the same way. And I think that's to do a disservice to the Bible, because it is written in so many different genres and through so many different, if you like, lenses. But you see, but this extraordinary harmony that exists across the whole of it at the same time, which for me is another clue to its divine source. And so for me, I welcome, you know, hearing views which challenge my thinking, which, you know, hopefully open up new ways of thinking about scripture, all the time hopefully submitting it to the lordship of Jesus Christ, and hopefully the humility that comes with trying to read things through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit.
And the humility is evident in your words. And I love what you say about mere Christianity. You know, this has been the motto of our ministry: in essentials, unity; non-essentials, liberty; all things, charity. And I think this is particularly important in the epoch of time in which we live, where we have a liberalism, in a sense, you might say, not to use too much hyperbole here, but the wolves at the door. And if we don't, as Benjamin Franklin once said, hang together, we're going to hang separately. And so I think it's important for us to work together on common cause issues, to be open to dialogue and debate. And I think that's really what you have modeled in what you have just said, but also what you're modeling with respect to the show that you do.
Yeah. And in that sense, I've tried to, in a sense, we do those Christian debates where we have people of different perspectives and theologies, you know, engaging with each other. But I think it's really important that we show, because there are a lot of non-Christians listening to the program on a weekly basis, that we can agree to disagree about some of these, the non-essentials, but there is a common unity, that there is something distinctive about Christians, and that we can still call each other a brother and sister in Christ, even if we may disagree on some of these other issues. And for me, it's actually interesting the way actually in which very often Christians are capable of forgetting some of the differences they do have when they find, if you like, a common cause in responding to, you know, aggressive secularism or, you know, a very fundamentalist form of Islam. They're, at that point, I often find Christians are willing to drop some of the issues that separate them from each other and see that actually there are important issues that we need to be bringing ourselves together over and responding to. And that's when I actually see Christians from very different perspectives who can appreciate the work that each of them are doing in this regard, be they Catholic or Orthodox or Protestant, in responding to some of these important issues that are being presented, if you like, as threats to Christendom as a whole in many ways.
And I think you're doing just a terrific job, particularly in the context in which you live. I mean, it's not easy to do what you're doing in the UK. We take a lot of the liberties we have on radio and in podcasting and in communications in general, we take them for granted in the US. They may not always be with us, but they're with us. Now we have religious liberties and we can say what we want. There's some limitation to that. But again, what I'm trying to do is simply applaud you for what you're doing within the context of the country in which you're working. What are some of the strongest arguments that skeptics have presented against Christianity? I mean, I think about the shows you've done, the number of shows you've done. You do all of these shows and there are some of these arguments that stick in your mind and you keep cogitating. What are those strong arguments that keep you up at night?
Well, I mean, over the years, there have been different ones. And, you know, when I started The Unbelievable Show, you know, I was very wet behind the ears. There were lots of objections to Christianity that I had not even thought of, let alone engaged with. But doing the show obviously forced me to come to terms with a lot of issues. Perhaps, a few years in, I had a well-known Bible scholar and skeptic, Bart Ehrman, come on the show. I'm sure he's a name familiar to you, Hank.
Know him well.
But, you know, his books have sold very well in the popular market, questioning the historicity of the Gospels, questioning the reliability and so on of the Gospels and the New Testament generally. And probably his best-selling book at the time that he came on to talk about some time back was Misquoting Jesus. And when I read that book, you know, a lot of the arguments Bart put there, questioning, you know, various aspects of the historicity of the Gospels and so on, did leave me feeling very uncomfortable. It did give me a couple of sleepless nights and questioning, you know, how do we know that we've got the correct, you know, words, and that these manuscripts that were copied time and time again over centuries, and all of those sorts of issues that Bart brings up. Now, inevitably, it's only really when you read the other side that you get a more balanced view on what's going on. The person I had on with him is a very good scholar from Cambridge, Peter J. Williams, who's the warden of Tyndale House in Cambridge. And he was quite the equal match for Bart. Peter J. Williams knows perfectly well the entire history of biblical scholarship and the nature of textual criticism and the various variations that we find between manuscripts and how, but he also was able to explain the art of how scholarship has been able to get us back to, you know, 99.5% or whatever confidence in the original words of those manuscripts, precisely because we have such a wide variety of those manuscripts and everything else. And for me, that was, the way that Peter J. Williams himself put it on the show was, well, Bart, you're a glass half empty kind of guy, and I'm a glass half full kind of guy. There's always a way to spin these issues to either make things look terribly bad or actually to help people realize, actually, this is rather good when you consider the kind of text, what we have as evidence for text for any other kind of ancient literature of the time. And you realize, actually, the Bible, it turns out, is extraordinarily strong within its genre as a historical document. And so those kinds of journeys I've had to go on, where I have had to sort of be exposed, if you like, to the critical argument, but then gradually see, okay, things aren't as simple as are being painted, maybe, or there is a particular spin that people tend to put on things. And as I've continued to engage with that whole area, I've met some fabulous scholars, people like Richard Borkham and others, who are just doing brilliant work, actually, at constantly revealing new aspects of the way that the Gospels are outstanding historical records of their time, and doing great work in uncovering some of the rich textual clues that help us to see that.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you talk about Bart Ehrman, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. One of my daughters went to school there, and she was very, very familiar with Bart Ehrman and his tactics, and the fact that he's very proud of the reality that the Christians that come into his classroom, almost without exception, end up discarding the Christian faith. But he makes a lot of dogmatic assertions, like that the Bible is filled with intentional lies. It's deliberately dishonest, that it is anti-Semitic. He calls Jesus Christ a false apocalyptic prophet. All of this, however, I think, in having studied Bart Ehrman and his objections over a long period of time, in fact, I deal with many of his objections in a book called Has God Spoken? All of his objections, I think, are grounded in the fact that he is what I would call a fundamentalist on the left. There are fundamentalists on the right, and there are fundamentalists on the left. And they both have the same disease. They read the Bible in a wooden, literalistic fashion, out of which nothing but nonsense can emerge. So he says that his doubt began with the idea of the mustard seed being the smallest of all seeds. And if Jesus thought that the mustard seed was the smallest of all seeds, then he couldn't have been God, because obviously orchid seeds are smaller than mustard seeds. Well, what he's trying to do there is take a parable and make it walk on all fours, as opposed to reading the parable in the sense in which it's intended. And this, again, is a fundamentalist reading of Scripture. It's the same tact that he uses in making Jesus a false apocalyptic prophet. And the thing is, and you alluded to this, is he's had great success at it. I mean, he has sold millions and millions of books. And when you look at his objections to the Christian faith, at the end of the day, they look strong to the untrained mind, but if you spend a little time looking at the objections, they're pretty flimsy at best.
Yeah, and that was kind of the conclusion I came to at the end of having this discussion with Peter J. Williams, who very helpfully kind of pointed out that in the end, you know, after spending a whole book kind of questioning the authenticity and historicity of the Gospels, there were only five places in the Gospels where Barth actually outlined where there might be some question mark over what the original text said. And even in those cases, he had an opinion on what they said. So when you actually got down to brass tacks, it turned out that after so many pages of casting doubt upon the testimony of the Gospels, it turned out actually, you know, nothing was actually in question, really, of any significance. And that was the interesting takeaway from that one. But I fully appreciate your comment about the idea that very often, you know, someone who perhaps grows up in a fundamentalist viewpoint sort of then reacts in an equally fundamentalist way against it. And what they're reacting to is something that, you know, no thinking Christian actually believes anyway. I kind of see the same thing going on with a character like Richard Dawkins, where he's very happy to dismiss derisively a kind of very naive fundamentalist version of Christianity, because that's the easy one to knock down. You know, it's very easy to erect straw men only to knock them down. But when presented with more coherent, nuanced, theologically thought through ways of thinking about Christianity, he struggles, you know, and I think he prefers to have, if you like, you know, the easy targets to demolish, because that suits his narrative quite well. But he's, you know, he's always dodged doing a debate with a William Lane Craig, for instance, because he knows actually he'd be on far trickier ground, you know, talking to someone who has their intellectual wits about them in that way.
A final question has to do with the subtitle of your book. I found it very, very intriguing. Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. Cash that out a little bit.
Yeah, essentially, it's what it says on the tin, simply that I went into this program with the intention of trying to open up these questions. And over the years, the majority of people I've done that with on the other side have been atheists. And that what I came away realizing is that, as I said before, we all approach life through a certain perspective, through a certain worldview. And I came to realize that it's not that we Christians are somehow having to stand within our worldview and justify it to the neutral atheist, as though we're the one who holds all the burden of proof all these strange beliefs we have in God and the supernatural and Jesus. In fact, we're all standing from within a worldview. And on average, the atheists I meet tend to believe a certain set of fairly dogmatic beliefs about life, that the universe came from nowhere and is going nowhere, that there's no ultimate right or wrong in the world, that life ultimately doesn't have a specific purpose. And I could go on to list other aspects of what are entailed by what you might call scientific materialism or naturalism. And the problem with that is that you then have to justify why you have those beliefs. And in fact, when you look at a lot of aspects of our universe, and when you look within ourselves at our moral beliefs, you suddenly start to realize, well, a lot of that doesn't seem to jive very well with the way we actually encounter life and the universe. And so I simply try to point out all along the way that I'm not giving, you know, iron cast proofs for God here. I'm simply asking people to consider, when you put Christianity and atheist naturalism side by side, it turns out that Christianity explains an awful lot of what we see around us. And there are some gaping holes in the account that naturalism tells us about the universe. And that it makes intellectual sense to believe this. And that those people who find themselves drawn towards the story of Christianity, the beauty of Christ, well, that's not just a feeling. That's saying something that's true about life, there's an intellectual bedrock to that as well. And we can be both a spiritually and intellectually satisfied Christian and hold our heads high in that sense. That's not to say that the atheists I meet aren't very intelligent people with very important questions and arguments and objections. Nonetheless, I've found that having looked into it and having heard some of the very best objections and some of the most famous atheist voices in the world, I have found that Christianity can stand on its own two feet and is still a compelling explanation of reality.
Well said. Christianity corresponds to reality. Justin, keep up the good work. I appreciate your ingenuity and your faithfulness in doing this show for over 10 years. The book is a great read. And by the way, if someone wants to order the book through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, be pleased to send you a copy for your support of the ministry. Check it out on the web at equip.org or simply write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also talk to our resource consultants, 888-7000, and the letters CRI. And do remember that this is a podcast that is growing in popularity because people that listen are sharing the podcast with other people. As well, they're going to iTunes and giving us a five-star rating like CGH Studios, the rating 5 stars, and the comment many people have had the opportunity to hear Hank for decades on his popular radio show, now available in podcast form. Those episodes are an appetizer to the conversations on Hank Unplugged. The depth to the topics discussed on Hank's Unplugged podcast provide more of what open-minded, serious thinkers want. Thank you, Hank. And well, thank you for your 5-star rating. And again, please go to iTunes. If you love the podcast, give us a 5-star rating. This will ensure that people hear about Justin Brierley even more than they've already heard about him before. And of course, all the other fantastic guests that we have. We keep getting just the most incredible people on this podcast. It's fun for me to do because of the people that I'm interviewing or having a conversation with. So once again, thank you, Justin.
Thank you so much, Hank. It's been an absolute delight to be with you today.
Well, you've been wonderful. And do remember to tune in to the next edition of Hank Unplugged and look at the large archive of Unplugged podcasts at equip.org. So long for now.